Hey y'all, welcome back to Root Cause Radio. Today we are going to dive straight in to how to improve your fertility.
Yes, and I know you guys, if you listened to our last podcast, we went on to the nitty-gritty of why you might be struggling to get pregnant. So this episode really is going to build upon that. Definitely recommend listening to it before you go right into this. But then we're going to just jump right into, you know, all the steps that you should take from testing to food and diet to other sort of supplements and lifestyle support to help improve fertility and outcomes.
Yes, that was such a good episode. We had so much fun and jam-packed it. So make sure you go back to that episode. And then right now, we're just going to get started right away with what's the testing that you should do when it comes down to fertility. So good news is, you guys, I'm going to just type this into the description. That way you guys have a laundry list. But Anya, let's just give them first and foremost kind of like a recap of the blood work that we want to pull and why we're going to be pulling that first.
Yeah. So, you know, first just with blood work, you should be able to go to your doctor and rely on them to give you a full comprehensive workup. But unfortunately, often we need to advocate for ourselves. So you definitely should review the work that they're ordering for you. And if any of these markers or any of these categories are missing, speak to them about it. So, you know, first and foremost would be looking at all the sex hormones, right? And we're thinking things like FSH, LH, prolactin, estrogen, progesterone, DHEA, and testosterone are the main ones that come to mind. Sex hormone binding globulin as well. Most doctors will run at most of these, but not always. And also you have to keep in mind that the day when you collect sex hormone tests is really important where you are in your cycle because some of these do fluctuate. I like to say we want like a day three, looking at FSH and estrogen, and then around day like 19 through 22 or about 5 to 7 days after ovulation is when we want to look at things like progesterone.
Yes. What I like to do is if I'm not pulling FSH and LH, then I like to see typically your hormones done 5 to 7 days before your projected period or a couple days after ovulation, because that's when estrogen and progesterone are going to have that peak there. And then if you're only doing estrogen or you're only doing FSH and LH, then you can do them on day three, which day one would be the first day you bleed. Day three is, of course, 3 days of bleeding. So that's where we suggest. And then thyroid, that never really matters when you're going to do it. Some people believe, and there's some school of thought that your thyroid hormones slightly increase during ovulation, basically making you frisky, but just pull them whenever. And if you're on thyroid medication, talk to your doctor if you should do your labs on medication or not on medication. So I will put down the full thyroid panel. And we've already talked about this on my podcast, but free T3, free T4, TSH, TPO, TGAB antibodies too. So you want to look at that full panel. And then when it comes down to nutrients, you guys, I am a big fan. If you're struggling with fertility, get the laundry list done, comprehensive testing. So the best thing to keep in mind is some doctors will push on this. And if they say no, because typically they go based off of insurance, they want to match a symptom with insurance to be able to order that lab and get paid for it. But I want you to do a comprehensive assessment, all your B vitamins, vitamin A, iodine, C, E, D, copper, ceruloplasm, ferritin, full iron panel. We talked about this last time. Zinc, MMA, homocysteine, uric acid. So good news is this is all going to be typed for you in the description. You could either take this to your doctor, self-order it, or you can email me or Anya, and we are happy to do blood work for you as well. Of course, with an assessment, but happy to help you guys out.
Yeah. And, you know, keep in mind with micronutrients that just because you eat what feels like and it maybe is a really robust nutrient-rich diet does not mean that your micronutrient status is excellent. There's a lot of reasons why that could be happening, but we're not just what we eat, we're what we digest and absorb. And just like for a quick note, MMA and homocysteine. So those are both ways to look at B vitamins. So MMA is methylmalonic acid. It's a marker of B12 status. It's more accurate than just assessing B12 in the serum. So when MMA is elevated, that usually means that B12 is low. And then homocysteine is usually elevated when there is an issue with methylation. And when there's an issue with methylation, which is a metabolic process happening all over the place. There's an issue with B vitamin metabolism. So there could be other B vitamin deficiencies involved with that. So a little indirect, but actually more accurate at assessing B status.
Yes. And two, if you have a like MTHFR gene mutation, which kind of like causes you issues with processing methylated or non-methylated Bs or folate, then we love using homocysteine also to see, is that gene mutation actually causing you to have issues too? Just because you have an MTHFR mutation doesn't mean it's necessarily causing you a specific issue with methylation at that time. So homocysteine can be very helpful for that as well, because it'll start to elevate if you're having that issues with methylation, which typically is because of a nutrient deficiency. But of course, there's more like toxins and inflammation that can cause that to elevate too.
Yeah. And so, and homocysteine is also just, you know, a really good measure of assessing overall inflammation, because when homocysteine builds up or accumulates, it also causes inflammation. And so that is an important marker in that sort of whole inflammatory assessment. Mm-hmm. Another good marker of inflammation they should always test for is hsCRP. So it's high sensitivity C-reactive protein. This is also more of a marker of more systemic inflammation. I prefer it over just like the classical CRP. Definitely want to do that pretty much every time you get blood work, but specifically for fertility, if there's an issue with inflammation, you're going to have trouble getting pregnant.
Yeah, I would unfortunately, Anya, do you actually see that elevated? Because I don't see it actually elevate most of the time, unless there's like significant autoimmune or gut pathogen present.
I see it elevated quite often, actually.
That's good. That's good. And then yeah. You guys, CMP, CBC, two things I always recommend as well, because the CMP, you're looking at your kidney, your liver function, your electrolytes, marker of inflammation for bun. And then of course, CBC, you're looking at potential infections, deficiencies, anemias, things like intoxicities as well. So just get that full comprehensive panel, have somebody who knows how to look at blood work, look at that.
Mm-hmm. And most times that you get blood work done with your doctor, they almost always will do a CBC and a CMP. They're pretty cheap, often covered by insurance. But again, you know, just because everything's in the normal conventional range doesn't really mean it is that optimal. So for example, like ALT and AST are liver function enzymes that are usually tested on a CMP. I like to see those anywhere below 20, between 20 and 30, even though that's usually conventionally accepted, could indicate that there may be a slight liver issue or that your liver at least needs a little extra support. So that's something to keep in mind. Also, alkaline phosphatase is another marker on a CMP that is an indirect way to assess for things like magnesium and zinc. So, you know, just some things to keep in mind, that's why you really want an expert who's interpreting your labs as well and looking at them with that functional fine-toothed comb.
Yes, yes, because you can even check and potentially find a potential adrenal issue just by looking at a CMP, by looking at sodium, potassium, chloride. Definitely you can assess for that. And then we talked about in the past podcast, blood sugar regulation. So you also want to do a hemoglobin A1C. The glucose will be in the CMP, but a hemoglobin A1C and a fasting insulin as well. And that will help you with assessing what your blood sugar management or, you know, type 2 diabetes risk, pre-diabetic risk would be too.
Yeah. And again, these are all really interconnected, right? Because if there's an issue with like, you know, insulin resistance, there's almost always going to be also an issue with inflammation. Mm-hmm. And if there's an issue with inflammation, you know, there's going to be other systemic problems down the road. So yes, definitely blood sugar management. Another thing too, that I really do like to assess for in fertility testing is I'll do things like I'll run an ANA IFA panel, which is a general autoimmunity screen. I might even do like gluten sensitivity testing as well. I also sometimes will do things like a GGT to look at, again, liver function or tissue damage. Those are some kind of like extra labs that I guess aren't necessarily like necessary for everyone looking to get pregnant, but in cases where I have clients who are like, you know, really struggling and really have trouble finding answers, those are things that I like to tack on to.
Yeah, that's great. I'm a big fan. Like blood work, fantastic. Please always start there. You don't necessarily have to go do a full Dutch. Always you can start with just blood testing, which moves us into a Dutch test, right? So if you expect there to be any shape or form of cortisol issue, you could either pull a 4 or 6 point cortisol. The 6 point would include your cortisol weakening response, which gives you a better clinical picture, or you could pull a Dutch test, and then they have the Dutch complete, which is urine, doesn't include saliva cortisol, the Dutch plus that does have that saliva cortisol. So I'm a big fan. If you are having irregular periods, start with blood, right? Because you're potentially wasting your money not seeing actually where those hormones are at the place that you want them to be in when you do that Dutch test. But if you have a steady, consistent period, and say that you have really painful, heavy periods, bad PMS, and you know exactly when you ovulate and when you have your cycle, it might be very helpful to look at that Dutch, because you're going to get saliva, you're going to get estrogen, you're going to get estrogen and testosterone metabolization, and a lot of neurotransmitters with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Dutch, but you have to be a candidate for it. Otherwise, you're throwing away your money. I usually say that, like, I really want my clients who are doing a Dutch to be very, very intimately familiar with their cycle and when they ovulate, because the timing of the Dutch test really matters. Again, it needs to be like in that mid luteal phase, about 5-7 days after ovulation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I usually say, like, if someone's using, like, you know, temperature tracking or any sort of fertility awareness method to really pinpoint when you're ovulating and make sure that you time the test accordingly. I'll even have some people do LH testing strips, just urine testing for LH surge to, again, determine when you're ovulating. And if you're not having consistent cycles, blood work is your go-to, but you can still do just that adrenal panel. I don't love cortisol testing in the blood for a lot of reasons. First of all, your cortisol does fluctuate throughout the day. It should. And we really want to make sure that your cortisol pattern is optimal. So, you know, maybe you have normal serum cortisol levels in the morning when you test, but then later in the day at night, you get some sort of rebound or something goes wonky. Mm-hmm. And then also with cortisol, it's not just your serum cortisol. We want to see how much you're producing, but also how much you're metabolizing, how much you're actually using. So the Dutch is able to look at both of those.
I freaking am a big fan of the Dutch. Love it. And then also, if you have issues with maybe getting pregnant, then you can also use the Dutch cycle map. And there's so many other, different companies that do this, but that allows you to see what your estrogen and your progesterone look like throughout your entire cycle. There's I think it's called Anito and then Prove too, that you can check those things. A lot of different tests and things that you could do, but I do like the cycle map for looking at what those levels look like throughout the rest of your cycle. For example, you could see, hey, in the cycle, did I not sustain progesterone? Did my estrogen, was it lower during a period of time or higher at a period of time? And allow you to see that entire hormone cycle for you.
Yeah, it's really cool. Cause I mean, I'm sure a lot of women have seen those graphs that show how your sex hormones are supposed to fluctuate in a normal menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. But there is so much deviation with that. So it's really cool to see your own personal cycle map and what those fluctuations are looking like. I was going to ask too, because I get asked this a lot. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. The Dutch complete versus Dutch plus. Like, why or what sort of person do you feel like would be a better candidate for doing the Dutch plus over complete?
Well, with the Dutch complete, we're only looking at urinary cortisol. So that's going to not give me the full clinical picture for assessing the cortisol waking response and seeing what specific point and time frame that somebody's having high or low cortisol. That's where because the complete, you're looking at urinary. So that's a couple hours after that time frame that's actually pinpointed on the map. So I actually just like Dutch. I always am a big fan of saliva cortisol. It's always the most accurate. So I would say if somebody can afford the plus, I would do the plus.
Yeah. Like if you really suspect that cortisol is a huge issue for you and you really want to get that as good of an insight as possible, I do think it's worth just upgrading to a plus.
I mean, either way, the good news is if you're doing a complete, you're seeing total and metabolized cortisol, and you're seeing cortisone. So you're going to get a picture of the total cortisol creation. You're not just getting the most, you're just skipping the most accurate assessment on the time frames of your cortisol regulation, which can impact you. Say, for example, you actually have cortisol that's actually low, very low in the morning, but maybe on the Dutch complete, it might not necessarily show up that way because it's like 2 hours after. Then you might miss the opportunity to use an adaptogen that might linger cortisol in your body longer, like licorice, during that morning time frame.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So let's just reel out the rest of these tests so we can dive into the other things. So other testings, of course, ultrasounds, right? Pelvic exams, GAMAP for the gut, heavy metals or mycotoxin testing, or even environmental toxin testing if you need it.
Yeah, I think I've actually been using those more and more with my clients who are struggling with fertility, and it's quite amazing that the correlation that I'm starting to see with high levels of toxins and difficulty getting pregnant, right? Because really what's happening is it's increasing oxidative stress in the body. And oxidative stress, for those who don't know, basically means that there is an issue where there's a lot of compounds that are negatively affecting your DNA. And you know, again, if it could be, feel like it's something just specific to one sort of part of the body or one sort of system. But when it comes to fertility and when it comes to health in all of our different bodily functions and systems are all interconnected. So it could be an often missed, I feel like, factor.
Yep. So let's talk about diet to improve fertility. And as we already talked about the last podcast, you should be focusing on your diet 6 months to a year prior even to trying to conceive, because you are making a baby and a human and you need DNA and RNA to do that. And your diet impacts not only your own methylation, DNA, RNA creation, but impacts your egg follicular maturation, egg quality, and the DNA and RNA that your body and your baby is going to have too. So got to start way before even trying to conceive.
Absolutely. And listen, you don't know. So in that first trimester, when you're dealing with all the pregnancy nausea and whatnot, your diet might not be as nutrient rich as you want it to be. So take advantage of this while you can, because you might just be eating like crackers and rice for a period of time.
So let's start. What do we need to focus on when it comes down to diet for fertility?
Yeah, I mean, let's think of it like kind of like top to bottom, right? So like the upper end or the bigger picture thing is just going to be overall calories. So are you getting enough total energy from food? Are you eating enough? Are you not under eating? But same with, are you not overeating, right? So I think it's silly to throw out a specific number because it really can vary person to person. But honestly, I mean, if you're eating anywhere below 1600 calories, it's going to be very difficult to support your needs no matter what size you are. So definitely adequate calories. And if you aren't sure if you're eating enough calories, again, this is a really good spot to have a dietitian. But you could also use like, you know, other sort of like food tracking apps, like Chronometer is one, MyFitnessPal, get some insight for a little bit and see like if your calories are in what feels like an appropriate range for your size.
And it really depends per person, not only like your size, your height, your weight, but also your activity level and your past dieting with what calories you need to be sitting at. But I like to say, and of course, if you're overweight, you might actually need to be dieting. If you're underweight, you need to be gaining weight. But if your goal is fertility, you should probably be at or around at least above 1700. And if you're at like underweight at all, you should definitely be eating up to a 2000 or more. And then of course, if you need to lose weight in order to, because you have insulin resistance or, you know, you're overweight and you need to do that per your doctor, then you might need to be in a deficit. But just remember for the most part, low calorie dieting, over exercising is a stressor to your body, and that lowers your risk for sustaining progesterone and lowers your risk for not ovulating. And that of course can impact your fertility.
Remember again, like, fertility and getting pregnant, staying pregnant, having healthy pregnancy is all about making your body feel safe and making your body feel like it's in an environment where you could safely, happily raise a baby. And if your body thinks that food is scarce, why would it want to have a baby in that sort of environment, right? So definitely like And yeah, like you just said, really, I shouldn't have just said size because there's so many other factors that can contribute to needs. I've seen women who are very, very small require 3,000, 4,000 calories a day, you know, and vice versa. So just something to keep in mind that calorie needs really do vary.
They really do. So let's talk about macronutrients. That is going to be person by person dependent. So I'm not going to give, and I don't want Anya to give, any blanket macronutrient suggestion, but you guys need to understand that all three main macronutrients play a big role with optimal fertility. You need to have adequate amount of protein. Best way to say is at least a gram per body weight. Or you could say, you know, if you're training, I like to say a goal would be 1.5 to 2.5 grams per kilogram. Better if it's 2 to 2.5 grams per kilogram of body weight for protein. Carbs and fat are going to be different per person, right? If you're insulin resistant, you probably need more fats, less carbs. But you need to remember that too little fat, too little carbs is going to cause you issues with hormones. You need fat to make hormones. You need carbs to make hormones and for thyroid conversion. So you just don't want to undereat.
Yes. And I will say, like, fat especially, really, really important. Minimum, like 1 gram of fat per kilogram of body weight. But honestly, when you're trying to get pregnant, I'd say like at least like, you know, like 150% of that amount. Like, you really do need enough fat. And you know, the fat we're talking about is mostly healthy dietary fat. So things like plant oils of all kinds, like olive oil, avocado oil, coconut oil, nuts and nut butters, seeds and seed butters, avocados, ghee, or even, you know, grass-fed butter is a good source. And then we get some healthy dietary fat also from our animal-based sources. Things like egg yolk is a great example. And egg yolk also has so many other nutrients that are beneficial for fertility. But also things like chicken thigh, fatty fish are all really good sources.
Yeah, those are excellent. I always want to think anti-inflammatory diet or Mediterranean diet or whole food-based diet. That's the best way that you can think about it. Doing less of the processed vegetable oils and really focusing on whole nutrient-dense foods. And when it comes down to the carbohydrates in particular, I'm a big fan of looking at what carbs are going to have more fiber and more nutrients. For example, you should be going for more brown rice, sweet potato, and quinoa than a white rice or a packaged bread or, you know, any shape or form of white pastas, white tortillas. Try and ask yourself, how can I get more nutrients in this carbohydrate choice? How can I balance my blood sugar potentially better with this nutrient choice? But of course, digestion, how you feel with the food, also plays a big role. So just focus on consuming things that make you feel good, balance your blood sugar, and ask yourself, does this have more nutrients? So, I mean, my favorite grains, like I said, brown rice, quinoa, organic corn. If you can handle wheat, you could do sprouted organic wheat products, tortillas, things like that, chickpea or legume-based pastas, lentil chips, fruit, vegetables, all your potato varieties. So those are all good things to include.
Yeah, and fun fact. So certain starches, when you cook them and cool them, and that increases something called resistant starch, which can help sort of, you know, feed good bacteria in your gut, but it also can improve your glycemic response to that food. Mm-hmm. So what I say with clients who like are struggling with blood sugar issues, but like, let's say white rice is a big part of their diet or their culture, to pre-cook the white rice and then reheat it when it's ready to eat. And that'll help improve your body's reaction to it. And you could do the same thing with potatoes too. I love like prepping potatoes in bulk to increase that resistant starch.
I'm a big fan of overnight oats. I freaking love them because you can throw all the different flavors and the nuts and the seeds and the nut butters and the protein in there, and you get your resistant starch with the overnight oats too.
Yeah, I love that. I fell off the overnight oats train, but I kind of want to get back on.
Yeah, hop back on. And then also proteins. So I like to say, you know, there's so many good proteins, but you want a good variety of your proteins, especially your omega-3 rich proteins. So of course you can grab and go get your meats, you know, your chicken, turkey, beef, venison, elk, you can do your eggs, your egg whites, your fishes, your salmon, your halibut, everything. Focus on getting a variety of your proteins in, and then you can incorporate protein powders if you want to, if you train, but do try and focus on whole food based proteins. And then if at all possible, I do personally suggest trying to go organic if you can. It's not a must, but do try to go organic if you can. Studies do show that it does elevate the omega-3 content with that. And of course, you are what that animal eats. So if the animal is eating non-organic food, then that does not necessarily mean that you're consuming pesticides, but it lowers the potential quality of their food and their food, which impacts their body. And so just try if you can.
Yeah. And, you know, as much as I love omega rich, fatty fish, just keep in mind that certain ones have, higher levels of mercury, right? And mercury poisoning or mercury toxicity, I've actually seen a lot be a limiting factor with fertility. So fish that are pretty high in mercury tend to be the larger fish, tuna, for example. I like to say if you're trying to get pregnant, I would, first of all, if you do eat a lot of tuna or a lot of sushi, I would test your mercury levels, but try and keep tuna to like once or maybe twice a week max if it's a small amount. Other fish that are like bigger, for example, swordfish is one that I'm always like, absolutely not, way too high in mercury. I'm so sorry. Instead go for those smaller fish. So things like sardines are excellent. I know they're an acquired taste, but like, you know, get them packed in some olive oil, squeeze some lemon in it, mash it with some avocado and make a little salad. I swear it's delicious. Mackerel is really good as well. Again, herring, these small fish are generally very low in mercury, high in omega-3s. Especially if you get something like sardines that are packed with the bones too, then you're getting a good amount of calcium from the bones as well. So they're kind of a pregnancy and fertility superfood in that regard.
Nice. I like it. And then when it comes down to, of course, those are the macronutrients. Please, micronutrients are a big focus. And so I know we mentioned in the last podcast, chronometer that you can use to just see what your general overall intake is like. But you guys, please eat an abundant rainbow. Like you should be focusing on all the colors of the rainbow, your leafy greens, your berries, your cruciferous vegetables, and all the purples, the reds, the greens, the blues, everything. Variety is going to be key. And an easy way to do that is focus on every single meal that you have two different color vegetables in there. And then every day have two different types of fruits, and that will give you a good variety.
Yeah. And then, you know, you can think of also making sure that you're getting foods that are extra, extra nutrient dense. So for example, microgreens are one of my favorite things. They're little baby greens, they're nutritional powerhouses, and you could sprinkle it on pretty much everything. You could put it on toast, you could put it on salads, you could put it on eggs, delicious, adds a lot of nutrients with very little like quantity at all. So that's a really good way to get in a good amount of food. And then other sort of micronutrient rich foods too are going to be your animal foods. You know, they are kind of like quote unquote superfoods for so many reasons. Those egg yolks that I mentioned before, such a great way to get in micronutrients, especially choline, which is a very important nutrient for fertility and pregnancy. You know, high quality grass-fed red meat also is excellent, particularly if you're struggling with iron or poor iron status. And then, you know, if you can stomach it, organ meats are amazing. Things like beef liver is fantastic. No. And, you know, you can put that in a meatball, you can make burgers out of it, or you can just kind of like, you know, you can even like freeze dry it and take it like a capsule. There's a lot of ways to eat it.
I'm literally nauseous. Gross. They do make the a powder now. They literally make a powder of like spleen, liver, heart. They make powders. Huh, thank God. Yeah, the things we do, the things you do.
The things we do. It's worth it though.
Definitely can be very helpful, especially because like high in glycine, high in iron, high in a lot of good vitamin A. So a lot of things, but yes. So the micronutrients, please, you guys, though, if you want to optimize your fertility, you want to optimize your postpartum life, because if you're nutrient deficient and you go through pregnancy, that elevates your risk of postpartum depression. Please just like check your micronutrients beforehand. Then you know what you also need to focus on. And in the meantime, just focus on an anti-inflammatory, nutrient-dense diet.
Absolutely. And, you know, while we are all about focusing on what you should be adding to your diet, that's also important to think of replacing certain things with these foods that we're talking about. So, you know, things that I often encourage people to limit are going to be, number one is alcohol. I really try and keep alcohol to a minimum. Obviously, when you're pregnant, you want to avoid it, but also when you're trying to get pregnant. And for a lot of different reasons, you know, of course there's like the negative impact of alcohol on fetal development, but even before that, like when you're just in that earlier phase, it does promote inflammation. It can also, you know, cause other sort of like blood sugar issues or metabolic issues. If it's in excess, it also can, like, you know, for example, it replaces other more nutrient dense calories for certain people. So I really like to try and keep alcohol to an absolute minimum. And I like to start that like at least 3 months, ideally 6 months before you're looking to even conceive.
Yeah, I fully agree. And lowering the amount of caffeine can be very helpful too, because that could be a stressor on your adrenal glands. So just moderate your caffeine intake and then moderate your sugar intake too, because sugar is, of course, if you're insulin resistant, definitely going to be an issue, but sugar has no nutrients in there. So just focus on your carbohydrates for being nutrient dense carbs that your body can use better for fuel, and that will give them the proper nutrition that they need.
Yeah. And you know, when we're talking about sugar specifically, we're talking about added sugar. So there is sugar that's naturally found in foods. For example, fruit. Fruit is going to have sugar. And really all carbohydrates in the body eventually, you know, become converted to glucose, sugar and whatnot. But what we're talking about specifically here are sugar or like sweeteners that are added to food purely for the purpose of sweetening it. So of course we have like classic table sugar or even like, you know, organic coconut sugar. It doesn't really matter. But then we also have things like honey, agave, other sort of syrups, all do kind of count under that sugar umbrella. So for example, like you might see like a health halo, like cookie that's like, it's organic. There's like no added sugar, but then you look at the ingredients facts and you're like, okay, wait, they're using like a ton of like maple syrup here. That's something that we want to limit as well. Now, luckily on nutrition facts labels, they do separate added sugar, from total sugar. So you want to keep that to a minimum.
And then when it comes down to quote unquote, like fertility versus pregnancy, there's a lot of differences here. So we could talk about the nuances behind that. But overall, I would say just be very careful too with raw fish, because that does elevate your risk of contracting a parasite. And that's nothing that you want to have prior to pregnancy, because that can be a potential miscarriage trigger. So I would just say if you can, maybe avoid sushi if your goal is getting pregnant in the next 2 months.
Yeah, or like
it's a very controversial thing to say. It really is.
No, I agree with that. And what I usually say is like, if you go out for sushi, get cooked rolls. So you can get a cooked shrimp roll, or some places will do a cooked salmon roll. You know, and then of course, like there's things like edamame, like miso soup, like, you know, other sort of things that you can get on the menu as well. But I do agree that like, really, and it's not just sushi, right? It's also things like oysters. I really raw say meat. Try and, yeah, I mean, yeah, any sort of like, you know, tartare sort of dishes, I usually try and get people to avoid. And if you're traveling anywhere where the water supply is a little questionable, I say this too. I say avoid any sort of like raw vegetables even in those sort of countries or places, and offer cooked. So it might sound counterintuitive, but like if you're going to Mexico, don't eat the salad, you know, get fajitas with some cooked vegetables to help avoid that sort of, you know, risk of food poisoning.
Yeah, that's sad. Any other foods that you would say to avoid specifically for fertility, Anya?
Yeah, I mean, I think we briefly mentioned this, but like the more inflammatory oils, so I know there's a lot of buzz around seed oils, but like things like, you know, canola oil or other vegetable oils, I usually say like, if you're cooking it at high temperatures, definitely avoid it. At home, it's okay if there's like a little bit in something like a salad dressing or like something that isn't necessarily cooked, I don't worry about it. It's really the oxidation that concerns me the most. So really try and limit that at home. And then, you know, there's just individual things too, right? So certain people who have gluten sensitivity, or like, you know, maybe undiagnosed celiac disease even, like, need to avoid gluten. There, you know, there's this individual like food, adverse food reactions that could be occurring. So, and sometimes you don't really even know, right? But in those cases, you definitely want to avoid those triggers because it could be causing more inflammation, and, you know, disrupting GI function and whatnot.
Yeah. When it comes down to like avoiding foods, I like to say avoid things that you know you need to avoid for your own health. So if you know you have a gluten sensitivity, stay away from gluten. If you know you don't respond well when you have dairy, don't consume dairy. So avoid those things. But of course, always ask too, why can I not potentially handle this food? Is there a dysbiosis? Is there a yeast overgrowth? Is there an issue with my digestive capacity, lack of pancreatic enzymes? So that if you can't handle food, sometimes that's also a case to where you need to dig even deeper and figure out what's going on internally to why you can't handle that.
Absolutely.
So, okay, moving on, let's talk about supplementation. Oh, and by the way, you guys, diet, forgot to mention it, don't want to forget this, for calories. If you want to question, okay, maybe where should I be with my calories, you can always go to the Mifflin-St. George equation. It's something that we use as dietitians. A lot of personal trainers use it, but it allows you to use your weight, your height. I think it also includes like your body fat percentage, but in activity. So you can use that as a basis standing point if you have zero clue, but just wanted to throw out there, forgot to mention that. Okay, so supplements. Anya, I'll let you start. Let's talk about the top supplements that can be helpful for fertility.
Yeah, well, you know, first we're thinking vitamins and minerals, right? So first of all, you want to base this primarily based off of labs, right? If you have any sort of specific nutrient deficiencies, you want to supplement accordingly. You know, for example, vitamin D is a really big one that I see quite often. You want to supplement with vitamin D, but also it's important to note that all of these nutrients are all interacting with one another. So if you're taking vitamin D, you also need to take vitamin K and magnesium to increase bioavailability. Same with iron, right? If you have poor iron status, not only do you want to supplement with iron, but you might want to consider vitamin C, copper, and vitamin A as well to improve iron stores. You know, and also along the lines of vitamins and minerals, B vitamins as well are really huge. Of course, there's folate, but pretty much all B vitamins I like to supplement. And really, you can get this from a good quality prenatal, which I would start, again, at least 3 months before you're even looking to get pregnant.
Yeah, the key thing I like to say for vitamin D and for iron is check and see what your levels are. Do a comprehensive full iron panel, check your vitamin D level, and then supplement based on your current needs. Mm-hmm. It's probably not going to harm you to add vitamin C, which can be helpful for ovulation. Probably not going to ever harm you to add in B6, which can be helpful for PMS. And also if you're B6 deficient, energy deficient, but if you're doing vitamin D and iron, please just check those things prior to adding them in.
Yeah. Cause here's the thing. So certain vitamins are water soluble, meaning that if you have too much of them, our bodies just excrete that excess amount and it's not really a big deal. For example, vitamin C. Or B vitamins, we have too much of them, it's fine. We just kind of like pee it out. It's not a big deal. But other fat soluble vitamins like vitamins A, vitamin D, vitamin K, vitamin E, they're not so easily excreted. So you don't want to over supplement with those either, because that can cause toxicity and that can cause problems. Same with minerals. Some minerals you don't want to over supplement with, for example, iron. Don't just assume that you're iron deficient. Do a full panel and keep tabs closely when you're supplementing, because having too much iron can cause inflammation and can cause a whole other host of issues. Same, you know, with something like zinc, for example. A lot of people, they love zinc. I love zinc, but keep in mind that zinc and competes with copper for binding. So when you take a high dose of zinc for a while, that can lead to a copper imbalance. And then when you have a copper imbalance, that can lead to an iron issue. And then when you have an iron issue, it can lead to a thyroid issue, right? So you really want to keep tabs on all these things when you are supplementing with certain vitamins and minerals.
100%. And I know a lot of people think too, like, oh, I can never have too much magnesium. Yes, you can too. If you're having issues with retaining sodium, you have maybe low end range cortisol, you're always in fight or flight, then adding that magnesium can prevent you from being able to retain that sodium. And that can make you feel like an exhausted pigeon, have issues with shortness of breath, heart palpitations, anxiety. So things to keep in mind. More is not always better for some people.
Totally, totally. And also the form in which you're taking it really, really matters too. Like, you know, with magnesium, that's one of, I feel like a lot of people are familiar with how different the different types of magnesium are in the body, right? So I usually say like magnesium glycinate is usually the safest bet in terms of like being gentle and well absorbed. Yes. But, you know, some people, like maybe they're having some cognitive issues and they need something like magnesium threonate. Maybe they're having some mild, you know, constipation and they need a little bit of magnesium citrate. So it definitely depends, but you should know exactly what type of vitamin and mineral you're taking, what the form it's in, because that does impact absorption and the way it's being processed.
Exactly. And also when it comes down to specific vitamins or food-based supplements, also always a big fan, you need a good amount of DHA and EPA. So having a good fish oil that has at least 800 milligrams of DHA and EPA per day, definitely suggest if your goal is pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it. Do not skimp out on a good quality omega-3 because those are so easily oxidized. If you open the bottle and it smells extremely fishy, like a very slight fishy scent is like not really a big deal and normal, but if it smells extremely fishy, that's a sign that maybe there's a quality issue. So something to keep in mind, but I do love omega-3 supplements. Again, even if you eat fatty fish, especially if you're having any sort of inflammation issues, omega-3 supplementation can be a huge game changer. And it's so heavily researched. There's so much science behind using it at high doses to treat certain conditions.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I like to say at least the 800, but typically up to even 2 grams or per day can be beneficial. So that's suggested. Yeah. Other than that, of course, I do like to, and it depends on the person, but CoQ10, ashwagandha, those are other two ones that I like just in general. CoQ10 can help with egg quality. Definitely beneficial if you go to IVF, but IVF would be a whole different podcast. Ashwagandha can be very calming and nourishing to the body and does potentially play a role too with egg quality. But those would be two others. I have more than I want to suggest, but I want to let Anya talk too. So Anya, what other things do you want to talk about for herbs?
Well, this is not an herb, but acetyl L-carnitine in terms of egg quality is really helpful. It's an antioxidant, and it could help also with things like mitochondrial structure and just general egg cell health is a huge one. Alpha lipoic acid also is a really big one, important for overall energy. But also it's a very strong antioxidant. So if you're having any sort of oxidative stress, that can be really, really helpful too. Mm. In terms of herbs, oh my God, there's so many. I think chasteberry or Vitex is the top one that comes to mind. This can be really helpful for certain cases, but not everyone. Right. So I really love Vitex if there's an issue with like, you know, slightly elevated prolactin, or low progesterone are like the two cases where I find it to be the most beneficial.
Yeah. Even estrogen dominance. I'm a big fan. Mm-hmm. As long as somebody doesn't have like, an issue when it comes down to like, so sometimes Vitex, we don't want to take it in regards to LH levels because it does help with that. I believe it increases LH, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So if someone already has high LH, you don't want to add Vitex.
Yeah. So that would be the situation in which you would not want to take it, which some types of PCOS that can call, be an issue, especially if you have a high estrogen. But like, I'm a big fan of Vitex. Very good for if you don't have periods, can kind of be a little kickstarter for some people. And then when it comes down to rhodiola and tribulus, I really like those two as well, because those can help with cases of anovulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tribulus is really nice. It's just a general sort of women's health support as well. And then other like adaptogens that can help with your body's, you know, stress response, something like holy basil. I really like milky oat straw is really nice as well for some nervous system support. You know, ashwagandha is amazing as well. Specifically, I really like Sensoril, you know, which is really, really helpful with cortisol levels, cognition, and other things like that.
And then another herb, couple herbs that I just like, a lot of people don't mention. I'm a big fan of black cohosh because it does actually help with ovulation. It helps to also stimulate the pituitary for release of LH. Mm-hmm. And then also Dong Quai, because it basically helps to improve the metabolism within the uterus. So that's helpful for implantation.
Yeah, those are good ones. Also Wild Yam. I really like that one as well for fertility support. Wild Yam. Yeah, and that's good for estrogen issues. It's good for progesterone. It really promotes healthy hormones in various different ways. And I like to combine that sometimes with things like chaseberry or Vitex as well. Mm-hmm. I find that those two together can be really nice.
And then we have maca, which maca has so many different qualities and benefits to it. And everything from anxiety to anovulation to estrogen dominance to low estrogen, like it's just a well-rounded good herb. I see most people do pretty well with that. Maybe 1-2% of the population has a little bit of anxiety or mood swings with it, but that would be a fantastic one. And then I totally forgot when we talked about nutrients. Inositol, how did I skip over that one? Goodness gracious.
Oh my God.
I know, right? Myo-inositol, y'all, helps with the brain to ovary communication, insulin sensitivity, reduces anxiety, helps to promote serotonin creation. It's the mother freaking bomb.
Yeah, specifically in combination with D-chiro-inositol in a 40-to-1 ratio. So great. So Inositol is like the leading brand, but there are plenty of other options as well. There's one that's called I think it's Balance B8 is what it's called. It has a little bit of folate too, which is nice. That's really, really helpful. The key though with that supplement, but with all supplements, is consistency. You really do need to take them every single day as instructed. With inositol, right. I find, most studies looking at the myo-inositol, D-chiro-inositol blends are looking at it taken both morning and night with food, so twice a day in divided doses. I find that's really, really hard for people to stick to. So I've started having people just do like those two scoops or like two servings together just once a day with food. And I've still found that to be really helpful and improve outcomes. But just make sure you start low and then kind of then go up to the two scoops, because I have had a few people that started right away with two scoops and have gotten a good amount of nausea or other GI upset. So start low and then titrate up. But that can be amazing specifically for PCOS. It's really, really life-changing.
Yeah, and it's fantastic too if you have any issues with sustaining progesterone as well. I find inositol to be extremely helpful for that.
Yeah.
And then last one, please do this based on your labs, but DHEA can be helpful. It is a pro-hormone, so it can turn into testosterone and estrogen. But if you have issues with low testosterone, low estrogen, or or follicular growth or egg maturity is an issue, then that's something that you can add in, especially with IVF. But please don't touch that unless you've done labs.
Specifically a Dutch. I really think that if you're going to take DHEA, you should do a Dutch test, because you want to see how you're metabolizing all these sex hormones, right? So let's say you have a strong preference for the 5-alpha pathway, which is a sort of, metabolite of testosterone or androgens. Then if you supplement with DHEA, it can lead to sort of like high androgen symptoms like acne, irritability, or aggression. So something just to keep in mind, like DHEA for very specific cases based off labs can be really good, but I definitely wouldn't do it unless you have some good insights from a Dutch.
Yeah. Now let's play a game, Anya. If you could choose one single supplement to help with fertility, what would it be?
Oh, that's really tough.
Really? Is that hard? Or mine's easy?
It's so hard. Really? What's yours?
I would just say a good prenatal.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cheating, because that's a bunch of things. Yeah. Yeah. I agree though. That was the first thing that came to mind for sure. And guys, I'm sorry, because I get asked this all the time when I'm doing prenatal supplements with clients. Like, you're not going to find a good prenatal where you just take one capsule. You just can't fit all those nutrients into one capsule.
No, you can't. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if you struggle with taking capsules, do a powder. I love the brand Needed for prenatal powders, and I think they taste good. They have different flavors. They're delicious. The really high dose of choline too. But other than that, you might be stuck taking 6-8 capsules, and that's just the reality.
Yeah, I like Seeking Health and I like Fullwell too. Those would be my top two. Thorne makes a great one as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or pre-encapsulations is a good one too.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on. Let's talk about exercise. What would be the best exercise for fertility?
Yeah. So, you know, listen, you want to find that sweet spot, right? Where you are getting a good amount of stimulus, but you're not overdoing it. So I like to say strength training, but keep it moderate, like 3-4 times a week, 60-70% of your intensity. Like you shouldn't be like pushing yourself super, super hard in the gym at this stage if you are looking to get pregnant and optimize fertility outcomes. That doesn't mean that you have to just kind of like, you know, walk around like lazy daisy in the gym, but like you shouldn't leave feeling like very fatigued. Like you want to take a nap. You shouldn't be having ongoing soreness. You know, that sort of thing. I usually like to kind of say that, and then maybe something like some Pilates is excellent just to work on that pelvic floor function. And then other than that, walking is a very underrated way to get exercise. That's a low intensity cardio for you. Good way just to get things flowing, improve that blood flow, which is really important to get blood flow down there. So those would be my top suggestions regarding exercise.
Well, yeah, I would agree. Yeah, some weight training, 100%. Weight training, yoga. I would stay away from any endurance type of work or any high intensity type of work. So I would say if you want to run a few times a week, that's okay. But I wouldn't do any marathon type of training, no CrossFit. I would stay away from like the 9-round and the Orange Theory, because that can be all very, very stressful to your body. And that can communicate to your body, hey, it's not safe. I don't have enough energy. And this is not an environment for me to have a baby. So I would really prioritize movements to where you feel good after training, you have enough energy, you recover well, and maybe just say, you know, 4 times a week, maybe 5 for some women. I think that's a great rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'd say the same thing.
Walking, I've my favorite activity in the entire world. I think everybody should be walking at least 6 to 7K a day. I think 10K is a little high, but I think walking is so beyond therapeutic for your body. It's good movement. You burn calories without being stressful to your body. And it's just going to overall impact your quality of life.
Yeah. And, you know, if you can't walk, or if you don't live in a place where walking is very much a part of your life, get a walking pad and walk when you're sending emails or doing admin work or watching TV. It's worth it.
Oh yeah, I freaking love my walking pad. It's so much fun.
I use mine once or twice a week. But when I do use it, I'm very grateful to have it. And it's like, I feel like that already pays off.
So we talked about exercise, and that can be person by person dependent too, y'all. If you have low cortisol, or if you really have low in range estrogen, you have issues with ovulation, you might be only able to walk or do yoga. So keep that in mind. But okay, what things else that you could do to support your fertility? Stress management, mind body practices. I am a big fan of, if you're having issues with fertility, please, 1, make sure you have a good therapist. 2, acupuncture can be extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of acupuncture for this. I've seen it be really, really life-changing. But again, it's in conjunction to everything else that we've talked about, right? So like all the acupuncture in the world is not going to help you if you have a nutrient deficiency or thyroid dysfunction, you know, or poor diet and lifestyle. But in conjunction to all these things, it could be an excellent adjunct therapy.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. And then just getting, like, having yourself surrounded by people and activities that you enjoy and love doing. So being active in your community, having good friendships, healthy friendships. I know that that's like, quote unquote, not a stress reduction strategy, but at the same time it is, because we are built to be in community and with people. So having that, it can be extremely important and helpful for you with your stress management and overall quality of life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What else you got for stress management and fertility support?
I feel like we've talked a lot about stress management and we've kind of brought it up throughout the podcast. But the one last thing I'd say is any sort of like, you know, meditation I find really, really helpful. I'm a huge fan of transcendental meditation. It's really been life-changing for me. But everyone with meditation, you have to find your glass slipper. even if it's just 5 minutes a day, it can make a huge difference. And again, there's a lot of science and research behind it. This is not woo-woo. It's, you know, it's very real, the effect that it can have. You know, getting pregnant starts with the brain. So if you're not doing anything to nurture your brain, you're going to have trouble down the road.
Right. And if you struggle with meditation, like I do, I love using, so I do prayer and then I do my Bible time, but I also like doing music therapy. So you could do binaural beats or alpha wave therapy. It basically communicates to your brain, puts you in a wavelength to where you have more of a parasympathetic rest and digest state. So that would be an alternative. There are things that you could do like, tapping, emotional freedom technique, heart math, a lot of other things that you could do, but I think those are a great start.
Yeah.
And then grounding in nature. I completely forgot that, but very good for your parasympathetic system as well. So putting your feet on the floor, grass, sand, getting in nature can be very therapeutic.
Of course. Huge fan.
A lot. Well, I wish I could just prescribe a vacation to everybody and just take them to the beach.
Seriously. Yeah. I mean, that sounds so nice right now.
I'm sorry. As I like live in Jacksonville, I'm like, oh, it's so easy. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm blessed. Oh, okay. Fantastic podcast here. You guys, as always, we are going to have another good episode coming out, but this was a lot. I hope it's helpful. And if anybody has questions, because we mentioned a lot of herbs, a lot of supplements, I don't mind if we talked about something here and you have questions, hey, is this a good dosage? Don't hesitate to shoot me a message.
Yeah, same here. Happy to help. And again, like, be your own advocate in terms of these labs, but it's not just the labs, it's the way it's interpreted with regards to your entire picture that's really important. So both of us, we're experts in this and we're happy to help.
Yeah, we've been put through the ringers in our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And please remember too, I probably should have said this when we talked about the herbs and the supplements. More is not better. So don't think you got to add everything that we suggested. You might just want to pull one or two. Maybe you add a little bit of inositol and Vitex, or you add inositol and rhodiola. Like, you don't need everything in the kitchen sink, right?
Yes, I know it's tempting, but yeah, more is not better.
Awesome. Any other last minute thoughts for today?
No, other than, you know, I know that this journey can be really, really mentally difficult for a lot of women. And so you're not alone. We're here to support you. It's important to have a good support system and have someone who's able to kind of hold your hand and just unload the stress of trying to figure this puzzle out for you. So
yeah, I love that. And I agree. And I say, like, you can easily try by yourself for like 3 months and trying to get pregnant. But like, if it's been 3 months and you're having issues, I probably would reach out to a doctor, functional medicine dietitian like Anya and I, who can really help you figure out what are the things that you may be missing out on and the changes that you need to make with your diet, lifestyle, or supplementation to improve your chances of getting pregnant.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, you guys, the lab link or the lab description will be down below. Thank you guys so much for your time. Please make sure to review this podcast. Well, leave a 5-star rating, that is. They took away the reviews, but leave a 5-star rating. Share it on your stories. And we thank you guys so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.